Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very special guest in store for you today. We're going to talk to Sally Fallon Morrell, who is president and treasurer and longtime contributor to the Weston A. Price Foundation. Weston A. Price was a pioneer in the field of nutrition, and we're going to talk a little bit more about his legacy. Weston Price Foundation is dedicated to promulgating some of the best information about diet and its relationship to our natural dietary, shall we say, suitabilities. Because one of the books that Sally Fallon has written is entitled Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet of dictocrats. I like that term, dictocrats. We'll get into that in just a little bit. Welcome to the program, Sally. It's nice having you aboard.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I think this is the first time we've talked. I think in the previous incarnation of Intelligent Medicine that was called Health Talk, we've talked to you several times before.
I think so, yes, I was going to say.
So, indeed. So, well, first of all, give us a basic review. The website is Weston A. Price, like the Price is Right, .org. And tell us, for those of our listeners who don't know who he was and what his contributions were, what that's all about.
Oh, okay. So Weston Price was actually a dentist. His practice was in the 30s and 40s in Cleveland, Ohio. And he traveled throughout the world. During the summer months, he traveled throughout the world studying what we would call indigenous peoples. They called them primitive peoples, but people who were still living their traditional lifestyle. And he found a number of groups that had perfect teeth, that is, virtually no cavities, and everybody had straight teeth in the village, you know, beautiful wide white smiles, no dental deformities, no crowded or crooked teeth. And the people who had excellent dental health also had excellent overall health, good structure, great immunity to disease, and easy childbirth. So his question was, well, what was it in these primitive diets that did this for them? And the diets were all different. There was the Alaskan diet where they were eating, you know, organ meats and blubber and fish, and then there was the South Seas diet where they had yams and seafood and pig, and then they in the Alps they ate sourdough bread and dairy products. So all the diets were different in the particulars, but the one really key factor was that all these diets were very nutrient dense, and they were particularly high in three vitamins that have more or less disappeared from the modern diet. These are vitamins A, D, and K. We call them the fat-soluble vitamins because they're found in animal fats. Yes, the foods we're told not to be to eat contained the most critical vitamins for normal physical development. So our bottom line, our take-home message is that to be healthy and to have healthy children generation after generation, children who don't need braces and children who are strong and smart and healthy, you need to eat the foods we're being told not to eat. So that includes organ meats, animal fats, butter and eggs from grass-fed animals, whole milk, whole raw milk, whole raw cheese, and certain types of seafood such as fish liver oils like cod liver oil, fish eggs, shellfish, and oily fish. And these are the foods that give us these critical nutrients, vitamins A, vitamin D, and vitamin K.
Well, it sort of sounds like the paleo diet, and indeed, Dr. Price, as a dentist, kind of tread the path of an anthropologist by going back to far-flung areas of the world to look at so-called primitive people or people in developing countries and to see what they ate. But the diet differs, I think, in a couple of fundamentals. One, it includes dairy, and dairy is sometimes thought to be not an original part of the human diet. It's an imposition that was recently enacted by civilization. So what do the Weston Price people feel say about that?
Well, the Weston Price diet is different from the paleo diet in almost every point. Many of the healthy groups that Dr. Price looked at used dairy. This was raw whole dairy, natural dairy foods, whether it was from reindeer or cows or sheep or goats or camel or water buffalo. And all anthropologists are agreed that the dairy, having herds, gave human beings evolutionary advantage. And these people were all extremely healthy. Also, many cultures, in fact, we know going back to the late Paleolithic, used grains often as a very substantial part of their diet. But the fundamental difference between the Weston Price diet and what's advocated by most of the paleo writers is the high levels of fat in our diet, where paleo people are telling you to eat lots of lean meat.
Right.
Well, traditional cultures never ate lean meat. If the meat was too lean or if the animal didn't have enough fat on it, these were thrown away. They made sure that they always ate meat with fat, and they knew they'd get very sick if they didn't eat the meat with the fat. So we're actually very concerned mainly about this, message to eat lots of lean meat. Our diet is actually just sort of moderate protein. No more than 20% of calories is protein. But what we really emphasize is the fats and getting the fat-soluble vitamins.
So your four animal protein and your four dairy products, but that doesn't mean go down to the fast food eatery and get a Big Mac with a shake,
right? Oh, of course not. Of course not. We have been the number one advocate for reconnecting with farmers and getting pasture-fed eggs, poultry, meat, and dairy. And that's because when your animals are outside in the sunlight eating green grass, you maximize the levels of these critical fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, and K. That's the key reason that we advocate grass-based agriculture.
Right. Even understanding that pork lard, if the pigs are allowed to graze outside in the sun, they sort of get a suntan, and their lard is higher in vitamin D. That's what I'm hearing.
It's much higher. I haven't published this yet, but I sent some supermarket lard and some grass-fed lard off to a laboratory, and the grass-fed lard was 12 times higher in vitamin D. In fact, one tablespoon of grass-fed lard was 1,100 units of vitamin D.
And that's a pretty good amount. Yeah.
That's a daily dose. That's what we need. So, we have this widespread vitamin D deficiency, and it's because people aren't cooking with lard anymore, or they're avoiding bacon and all of these good sources of vitamin D that they need.
Well, let's get back to this dairy connection, because it's kind of a cause celeb these days. Federal agents are raiding dairy farmers who do not follow USDA rules and subject their milk to processing and pasteurization. A lot of people are saying, look, raw milk, yeah, great, that in theory, but it could transmit disease. So we got to go with the modern thing. And, maybe that's does that dilute some of the benefits of the milk?
Well, actually, we've been keeping records now. We now know, first of all, we found out from a CDC survey that at least 10 million people in America drink raw milk. So with that piece of information, we can also figure out the rate of illness associated with raw milk. And that rate is 0.000005. It is a very low rate of illness. And, I'm not saying that raw milk has never made anyone sick, but any food has made people sick. So they're holding raw milk to a double standard. Now, it really wasn't federal agents coming in and harassing dairy farmers, but state agents.
Okay.
Because a dairy is
state-regulated.
It's state-regulated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this has died down quite a bit because we have set up the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which provides legal defense for dairy farmers. And we have kind of leveled the playing field, and really things have calmed down considerably. And at the same time, we've seen a liberalization of the laws in many states. We're now up to 40 states where farmers can provide raw milk one way or another. So we just have 10 to go.
That's great. That's great. I lost you momentarily. So you talk about the diet dictocrats in your book. Who are you referring to?
Well, these are the voices of government agencies and many medical groups, nonprofit medical groups, who are sort of speaking with one voice. Low-fat, lean meat, skim milk, don't use butter, don't use eggs, and I call these the diet dictocrats because they're sort of dictating what people are supposed to eat. And they're basically responsible for an epidemic of disease in this country, particularly among our children, because children need these animal fats and they need cholesterol for their brains to develop normally and for them to have healthy, normal digestion. And as a result of what the diet dictocrats have been telling people, we have an epidemic of learning disabilities and digestive disorders in our children. Excuse me.
Hey, I certainly would agree with you because, you know, whatever it is that they concocted, it hasn't worked out. The food pyramid or the, you know, the...
The food pyramid's part of that. And, of course, that gave Americans the green light to eat all the refined carbs they wanted to, or actually all the carbs they wanted to. And we're not against carbs, but we're against too many carbs. And we have seen a doubling of the obesity rates since that food pyramid came out. So this is not working, folks, and we need to rethink the whole thing.
So according to the Price Foundation, grains are not precluded from the diet. But do you take a particular stance vis-a-vis gluten or vis-a-vis wheat, or do you think that all the grains should be consumed in their whole form in moderation?
Well, what grains need is proper preparation. Grains are, of course, very hard to digest. They have an outer coating that's designed to make them hard to digest and that has a lot of what we call anti-nutrients in it. And when you look at traditional cultures, they prepared their grains by soaking, souring, fermenting, the sour leavening of bread. They very often made a beverage, a very sour fermented beverage out of grains. And that was a pre-digestion process that made it possible for humans to complete that digestive process. And the soaking and fermenting and souring gets rid of all the irritants and anti-nutrients in the grain. So this is what we recommend. This is what I recommend in my cookbook. All the grain recipes in my cookbook are soaked or soured first. And we've had countless thousands of people tell us that they couldn't eat grains before, but when they prepared them properly, they were fine. So our big thing is proper preparation. Now, there are some people who are extremely sensitive to grains and have very damaged intestinal tracts, and for sure, these people need to go off grains. But to just make this blanket statement that grains are bad for everybody just doesn't conform to the facts of what humans have eaten for thousands of years.
Indeed. So what you're saying is, you know, we could go back, 50,000 years and we won't see people cultivating grains, but human evolution has proceeded over millennia, and we did introduce grains, 10 or 12,000 years ago, at least some parts of the world, and humans acquired the ability to digest milk products and grains to some extent, but we may be overdoing it in our modern culture with refined products.
Well, actually, if you go back 50,000 years, you will find people eating grains, even if they didn't cultivate them.
Like gathering wild cereals.
They gathered wild cereals, and for example, the California Indians, who were considered the most primitive Indians, they gathered wild wheat and rye and oats, and 50% of their diet was grain.
Hmm.
And this was a very so-called primitive Paleolithic culture. So it's not, and I don't think people have become developed the ability to digest grains. I think it's just they've forgotten how to prepare them properly. None of us can really digest a grain unless it's been prepared properly.
I think that's a point well taken. So you have some pet peeves, Sally, for sure. And you're right out there. I don't think you pull your punches. So let's just start you off on some of your favorites. Natural agave syrup. You recently wrote a blog on the subject. Why did you?
Okay, so we need to first talk about high fructose corn syrup, which is made by taking corn, which is high in glucose, and putting it through a very horrendous fermentation process involving a lot of chemicals to produce, to change that glucose into fructose. And there's a couple of problems with the high fructose corn syrup. First of all, it's very high in fructose, sometimes more than 55%. It's free fructose, which seems to be problematic. And also that fructose is not exactly like the fructose in fruit. And so the body really can't use it. So it just does one of two things with it. It either puts it in the bloodstream as triglycerides or puts it into, stores it into fat. Now, agave is made the same way. You start with glucose in the agave root, and it goes through the same type of process to produce this sort of man-made fructose. But the difference between agave and high fructose corn syrup is that agave is about 90% fructose.
Oh, yeah. So it's even worse.
So it's worse. It's really much worse. And when high fructose corn syrup got its bad name, all of a sudden you started seeing this agave syrup in the health food store.
Right.
And, you know, we really have lots of natural sweeteners that nature gave us. We have honey, maple syrup. We have coconut sugar. We have, sorghum syrup. We have lots of things that we can use for sweeteners in moderation. We really don't need all these industrial sweeteners.
So what you're saying basically is that it's a little bit of a sleight of hand. The agave plant, you know, which looks like a beautiful desert plant, it has sort of the aura of it's healthier than corn, because we know, you know, corn-fed cattle, corn-fed Midwesterners shopping in supermarkets in Des Moines, but the agave plant somehow seems exotic and healthy somehow. But
well,
basically,
and the other thing is that they did actually make a natural sweetener from the flower, from the nectar of the flower. And if you can get that, that might be okay. But I believe that all of this agave sweetener that you find in the store is made from the root.
From the root. And, it's basic biochemistry, because you can take virtually any kind of carbohydrate plant and you can turn it into, well, you can certainly make it into alcohol. We know how that's tequila from those kind of plants. But you can also make refined sugar from beets, from potatoes, from sugar cane, corn, you name it. You can refine it, and very little of the natural goodness is left over after the refining process.
Right. We just kind of ruin things when we refine them.
So the people can find your blog on that subject at WestonAPrice.org?
Yes, well, it's an article, really. It's
okay.
Not a blog. In fact, our article on, there's an article about high fructose corn syrup and agave, and it's one of the most visited articles on our website.
Okay, great. So I'm just warming you up, Sally, because I'm now going to turn to your next most favorite subject, which is soy. What say ye about soy?
All right. Well, the Weston A. Price Foundation has been a kind of lone voice until recently warning the public about the dangers of soy. Now, we have come up against this blitz of propaganda for soy, and I think it's important to understand where this is coming from. 80% of the oil used in processed foods is soybean oil. And when they process the soybean, they're left with a residue of a very sludgy, high-protein residue. And the industry has figured out how to extract the protein from that residue and turn it into processed fake foods, you know, soy.
So what you're saying is that it's an inevitable byproduct of an industrial process that would ordinarily be considered sludge or waste, but they figured out a way to turn a profit even with that stuff. That could have, otherwise they would just dump it on a field as fertilizer.
Sound familiar?
Yeah.
So, and then what we did was we gathered up all the literature showing that soy is, in fact, just basically soy is a toxic plant. And particularly the proteins in soy are toxic. They're very toxic to the thyroid gland. And they contain, the soy protein contains these isoflavones, which are estrogen-like compounds that can cause endocrine disruption in humans. And we are actually seeing the really tragic results of a high soy diet in our prison population because...
Yeah, actually, you published a manifesto a while back, which is that, you know, we talk about cruel and unusual punishment in the prisons, you know, that they were using, like, tasers or starving patients or putting them in solitary. Your contention was that by feeding prisoners cheap soy-derived food, that this was cruel and unusual punishment. Very interesting angle.
Yeah, I mean, in the prisons in Illinois, it's up to 70% of their diet is soy. And what this is causing is horrendous digestive problems, thyroid problems, and endocrine disruption. A lot of these men grow breasts. And what we're ending up with is that when they come out of prison, they are so damaged, they have to go on, welfare. They can't work anymore. And it's a really, really sad situation. We do have a lawsuit ongoing about this, and we have expert witnesses and have shown all the science. So we'll see. Hopefully we can make some progress here.
Wow. So this is actually objective findings, not just a contention or a theoretical viewpoint on soy.
No, if you go to our website, we have a section called Soy Alert, and we have a list of all the studies showing adverse effects from soy. And we're particularly concerned about giving soy to babies, where it's their major food, and the baby's a very immature digestive tract and very vulnerable to hormonal influences. And fortunately, because of the work we've done doing, the use of soy formula is way, way down, but it's still being used for some babies.
So do you believe that soy is a goitrogen, and can you explain what that is?
Yes, a goitrogen is a substance that depresses thyroid function. We know that the isoflavones in soy depress thyroid function. There's several really good studies on this, and we've seen it happen in people on a lot of soy.
So to be the devil's advocate, I would say that the population of, say, Japan, perhaps China, they consume lots and lots of miso and tofu and various types of soy products like natto, and they actually have a pretty good life expectancy, and they're not dropping like flies. So how do you account for that discrepancy?
Well, yes, actually, they don't consume a lot of these foods, and there have been several surveys. The average consumption in Japan is about a tablespoon per day of soy products, and the average consumption in China is about a teaspoon per day. And the Japanese diet is high in iodine, and the traditional way of eating soy was fermented, which gets rid of quite a few of the anti-nutrients, but the isoflavones are still there, but they're just not eating a lot of it. And some people in the United States are eating much, much more soy.
Right.
If you're drinking soy milk every day, you're getting far more than you would get in a Japanese diet.
Well, I think what happens in the United States is excess zeal and commercial interests find common cause in promoting vegetarian foods or meat substitutes. You know, like I remember when I was a vegetarian, I was a macrobiotic vegetarian for quite a few years, I was consuming tofurkey for Thanksgiving, and I was having, texturized vegetable protein to make chili because I didn't want to put, it was chili con texturized vegetable protein, not chili con carne, you know, like a traditional Mexican diet might include. And so I was getting a lot of this poor quality soy in my diet.
Right. Well, even if it's good quality, it still has the isoflavones in it. So, yeah, you can really – I hope you didn't run into any problems.
I did, and that's why I actually switched. Yeah. I won't say that I developed a falsetto voice or that my thyroid crashed. But nonetheless, I do better on an omnivorous diet that's not unlike the Weston A. Price Foundation recommendations.
The interesting thing is that soy sales have really plummeted. Hardly anybody's buying soy milk anymore. The big thing right now is almond milk.
Yes.
Which
is that better?
Not nearly as bad. No, it's much, much better, but it still can't hold a candle to real milk. And all of a sudden now we're seeing people with lots and lots of sensitivities to almonds because they're overdoing the almonds. You have to remember that nuts and legumes and seeds all contain irritants and anti-nutrients, and they really need to be prepared properly. And I would say not to overdo any of them. And of course we overdo wheat in the United States and Western world, and so many people have developed these sensitivities to wheat.
Can you explain the origins of that? Because a lot of people, it's kind of counterintuitive. These are natural things. They're from the field. They're from nature. They're organic. And yet you say they contain toxins and irritants and anti-digestive agents. Why might nature pack those types of poor nutrients in what seem to be healthy foods?
Yeah, good question. Well, a seed is something that's designed to last a long time so that everything inside is kept fresh. So that when the conditions are right, that seed can sprout and grow. And what keeps those conditions fresh are what I call natural preservatives in the coating of the seed. These are things like phytic acid, enzyme inhibitors, tannins, and lectins, and so forth. So it's a marvelous system and definitely very important for life on this planet to continue. But they are preservatives, and we don't want to eat preservatives, not even natural ones. So what traditional cultures figured out is that they needed to ferment or sour these grains first, which neutralizes those preservatives.
Right. And I think a lot of people experience less in the way of GI problems, gas and bloating and excess of flatulence, irritable bowel symptoms when they reduce or eliminate some of these types of foods.
Yeah, absolutely. And or just prepare them properly and don't overdo.
Are you a fan of fermentation? I think you believe in naturally fermented foods.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that in my book, Nourishing Tradition, pretty much introduced the Western world to this concept of lactofermentation, which is a traditional way of preserving foods that increases the nutrients, increases the enzymes, increases the good bacteria. And, of course, our best example is sauerkraut, a natural raw sauerkraut, which when you're eating sauerkraut with every meal, you are getting a probiotic pill, so to speak. You're repopulating your gut or you're feeding your gut with good bacteria. And the enzymes in the sauerkraut help digestion, too. And I'll just tell you one story. I just heard the other day a gal who had had irritable bowel syndrome for many years started using really natural raw sauerkraut, and within 3 days, it had disappeared.
Hmm, fabulous. And I can, you know, we're big fans of that as well at the Hoffman Center. We recommend that people make their own because their recipes are making much better than, you know, a lot of the sauerkraut you get is just basically chopped cabbage in vinegar that's been pasteurized.
Right.
And
exactly.
It's not a live culture. So you go to the store and I just heard I should eat sauerkraut. That isn't necessarily going to be a live culture.
But the good thing is that there's lots of companies now making sauerkraut the way we think it should be made. And we publish a shopping guide which lists all these sources of good sauerkraut and good lacto-fermented foods.
Something I've heard about recently is fermented coconut milk. Are you into that?
Well, fermented coconut juice.
Juice, okay.
Yes, and they call it coconut kefir.
Yes, coconut kefir.
It's a great, it's a little bit sour and it's sparkly and just a great beverage to drink.
Which
And we're very keen on these lacto-fermented beverages, such as coconut kefir, such as kombucha, which are a wonderful healthy alternative to soft drinks, and which help your digestion and just give you a natural boost.
Great. Okay, among the myths of the diet dictocrats, great term that you coined, is that we ought to be restricting our sodium, that every man, woman, and child should be on a very low sodium diet because if we follow that, we won't get high blood pressure, we won't get strokes and heart attacks and die.
Oh, gosh. So we need, an adult needs about a teaspoon and a half of salt per day just to satisfy his sodium requirements. We actually need sodium. It's the basis of cellular metabolism. Growing children need sodium for the development of their brains. We need the chloride part of sodium chloride to produce hydrochloric acid for protein digestion. So, and a teaspoon and a half is about what Americans consume today. And the anti-salt people want this to be reduced to by half to three quarters of a teaspoon. We really should point out that we eat less salt now than we have in the past. Before we had refrigeration, all the meat and fish was salted, and the consumption was about three teaspoons per day. So we do not need to reduce salt any further. About 10% of the population does have their blood pressure go down when they reduce salt, but for most of the population, reducing salt has no effect on blood pressure.
It sounds like a little bit like our national healthcare system. In order to ensure the relatively small percentage of people who are uninsured. We've messed up the insurance for everyone. So
for
that's,
everybody,
since some people are salt sensitive, we're telling everybody to reduce their salt.
Right. And even those who are salt sensitive, they need to be careful, because if they don't get enough salt, they are going to have a tough time digesting and absorbing the nutrients in their food.
Indeed. Okay, so another myth that you tackle, and you can find this at the website westonaprice.org. Check it out and bookmark it, because there's some great articles there. High-protein diets cause osteoporosis, so the experts say. And that's one of the reasons why you want to be on a vegetarian or plant-based diet, not eat too much protein. What say ye?
Well, it's true. They've really looked into this, and just because you eat meat does not mean you're going to have weak bones or anything. I would say that too high protein is not good for you, but up to 20% of calories. 20% of calories is what I'd consider a high-protein diet. There is no evidence that this causes weakening of the bones or osteoporosis or anything like that.
And so you're a big proponent of the notion, and somebody coined the term, it's not you are what you eat, it's you are what you eat eats. In other words, find the source of the nutrition of the animal protein, because it makes a big difference.
It absolutely does make a big difference, and especially in the high levels of vitamins A, D, and K. And by the way, these vitamins, which are in the fats, are critical for healthy bones. And, of course, they're higher in the grass-fed animals. So, again, we say never eat lean meat. You always need to eat the fat with the meat. And, of course, the meat tastes so much better when you do that.
You know whose thought is very closely parallel to yours that I spoke to recently is Dr. Terry Walls, who is working
yes.
with multiple sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
She started suffering from MS herself.
Right.
She is, I believe, a neurologist, and or she's at the very least, she's a physician. And she has dramatically staved off deterioration in herself and now in her many patients and followers, and has written a book, The MS Protocol. It seems like the diet she espouses also is high in not just animal protein, but more looking at organ meats as a source of balance.
Yes, yes, and we really need to get back to eating organ meats. When you compare the nutrients in organ meats to just muscle meats, they're 10 to sometimes 1,000 times higher, especially things like B12 and B6 and vitamin A and so forth. So we need to eat liver once or twice a week, just like our ancestors did, just like the doctors used to tell us to do. We need to eat chicken livers and other organ meats like marrow and heart and brain. All these are what traditional cultures always ate, and they ate them in preference to the muscle meats.
What about cholesterol? Should people be restricting their cholesterol intake?
Well, I think most people don't realize this, but even the most ardent proponents of the cholesterol theory admitted that eating cholesterol has no effect on the levels of cholesterol in your blood. So there's no reason to avoid cholesterol-containing foods.
So our action points today, number one, go to the website westonaprice.org. Also, your book is available, Nourishing Traditions.
Yes, Nourishing Traditions. I also have a new book called The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care.
Great.
And they're available with online booksellers. Also, and we didn't touch on the subject, I'm
Please.
Coming out with a new book in September called Nourishing Broth.
Oh, and yeah, let's talk about that. That's a
yes.
very, very important concept. Talk to us about bone broth and the benefits of that.
Yes, almost all traditional cultures made use of bones, usually by making a bone broth. And the components of broth, the components that build healthy cartilage, the special amino acids, are like a synergistic twin sister to what's in meat. And so you want to include bone broth in your diet in soups and stews and gravies and sauces, and you'll find that you digest your meat a lot better. The components are very good for your skin, for digestion, for your bones, and even for your mental outlook. The glycine in broth balances the methionine in meat and gives you good, steady, even dopamine production. So broth can even improve your mood and it really needs to be something that we get back into our diet.
And this is not something that you're marketing at health food stores across the country as a cup of soup type thing in a package where you just rip open and you pour the powder into hot water, put it in the microwave. You have to really kind of render those bones.
I was going to say for the MS protocol, one of the important things is avoiding the neurotoxic components in the modern diet, and the main one is MSG, mm-hmm. which is what those soups are made of.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, great. It's been excellent visiting with you, and those are resources that people should be looking out for. Start with Nourishing Traditions and look for the two additional books that will be out soon.
The baby book's out. The grown book's out in September. So
great. I look very much forward to talking to you, and maybe we'll do a reprise late in the year.
Thank you for having me. It's
broth
always
story.
A pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Keep up the great work. Sally Fallon, who is president and treasurer of the Weston A. Price Foundation. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is Intelligent Medicine. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.